Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, now going on next month in its seventh year. And I'm back again with my good friend and colleague, Dr. Linda DeVillers. Welcome to this program again, Linda. It's been a couple of years plus, and that's too long, so glad you're back.
I'm delighted to be back. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we met each other most recently in Phoenix. And that was that in June?
Oh, no. That was in November.
No, that was more recently. That was November.
Right. We were at the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality annual conference.
Yes, we were. And it was a wonderful conference. And you very generously gave me your sixth fully revised edition of Love Skills. And the subtitle is really true: A Fun, Upbeat Guide to Sexful Relationships. And we've talked about this book before, but we're going to talk about it again since it's fully revised. And we're going to touch a little bit on Simple Sexy Food, your other great book. We'll touch a little bit on that and even more on that when you return for part two, 2017, and that'll be the 31st of January. And at that time, we'll also talk about part of your newly revised book has sections on gay and lesbian relationships. And that is needed. I have gay and lesbian listeners. And I got some feedback once from one saying he wished that we would focus more on homosexual relationships. And so we're going to do that on the 31st.
Right. And I will be happy not only to talk about what I put into Love Skills, but also in Phoenix, I was co-presenting with my gay graduate assistant on the topic of gay relationships and an online survey that we conducted in this past year.
Good. Well, we'll save that for the 31st and make it all about homosexuals. And but we'll also talk about Simple Sexy Food. You know, I was just pulling the book out again, and I wrote the foreword to it, and I wanted to just read to you, to the listeners, the first paragraph, because it tells how long we've been friends and how it came about. It was the summer of 1991 when Linda DeVillers and I first met in Amsterdam at the World Congress of Sexology. We enjoyed sessions and field trips with colleagues, noticing at once we were women of appetites, not at all afraid to feed our hunger. Since we both loved life and love and sensory adventures, we became friends. And that was our beginning, and it's just been more and more enriched over the years, and I'm grateful for that, Linda.
Thank you. I feel the same way.
Yes. Well, I'm really glad that you're back. So we decided with your newest, by the way, people can go to your website, drlindadevillers.com. And by the time we do the next show, it will even be better than it is now, you said, because you have somebody working on it, the website, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, but the current website is really good. You have a blog and real-life questions and answers to a wide variety of sexual concerns. And so it's really useful. And we're going to talk about some of those concerns during the course of this show. We thought we'd first start with Sternberg's
triangular theory of love, which, by the way, I'm quite sure we never discussed before.
Okay. Well, probably not, but it's good. I do bibliotherapy, and I revealed to you in our pre-interview that I have the Three Faces of Love from September 1986, Psychology Today, and it's all about Robert Sternberg's triangular theory of love. And I've given that article out quite a lot over the years that I've been in practice, which is, boy, it's 35 years now. And you're
right.
Close to that too, aren't you?
Yes, that's about right. I was licensed in 94. I mean, 84, excuse me.
84, yes.
Yeah.
And I was licensed in 81, but then had to do a three-year internship to get those 3,000 hours. And was it about the same for you?
Yeah, it was exactly 3,000 hours, uh-huh.
Yeah, so we're sort of parallel on that.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Robert Sternberg and his triangular theory of love, it's a very good way to conceptualize a love relationship. So let's talk a little bit about it. I always talk about the first, the left-hand side of the triangle is commitment, and that is the cognitive component of love. And a lot of people do that, and sometimes they do that and they lose the intimacy and the passion, the other two, and then all they have left is commitment, and some very old couples can probably represent some of that.
Well, let's reiterate for your listeners that Sternberg's theory, the three components of the triangular theory are commitment, passion, and intimacy.
Right.
And of course, he does start out saying that lots of relationships do start out with the passion element.
Mm-hmm.
And some will start out actually with the intimacy component before they wend their way into sexual activity, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously the commitment is the part that develops over time.
And the cognitive part of love, the commitment, sometimes that's when a couple decides to get married or that they are significant others to each other.
Right. And one of the things he says is that it's when you make the decision that I love somebody and want to remain with them. And I would highlight that I'm sure Sternberg agreed, but one of the mythologies, especially of American attitudes towards love, has been the concept that you fall in love. And maybe it would be more accurate to say we fall in lust. But
mm-hmm,
some very
mm-hmm.
big names going way back to Erich Fromm, a very famous psychoanalyst,
yes.
and Rollo May, who was an existential psychologist, and even a psychiatrist, oh, let me not blank on his name, which I am. But all of them talked about love is an act of will.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think
mm-hmm.
it's fair to say that it's cognitive, yes, but it's this decision element. And mine is not just an intellectual thing, as it were, but it's this, I choose to love this person and wish to be with them, you know, say over the long haul. And so the distinction on that, yes, but you do fall in love. No, you fall in lust.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I sometimes tell both clients and students, that if you see somebody and you immediately have that, you know, that visceral chemistry, ooh, and I've literally personally had this experience of the person mm-hmm. across the crowded room, you know,
mm-hmm.
some intense evening. But if you were to walk up to that person and after a 5-minute conversation or whatever, you found out that they asked you if you'd like to drop a little coke and that they'd just gotten out of jail and they were
yes.
still separated, that maybe you would indeed be able to put a lid on those initial lustful sentiments that you
right,
felt.
Right.
And it is quite possible to do that, especially
uh-huh.
better to do it early on rather than when it's too late.
Right, to see all the red flags that are there, but sometimes
exactly.
across a crowded room, some enchanted evening.
Yes.
It goes on.
So yes. I'm sorry, that's just my personal sort of take on that, because mm-hmm. I do think that commitment part, as you know, again, when I said it was very American, a lot of American stories and mythologies do have to do with the idea that love is all about feelings.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you can be irritated with somebody today or the last hour, but it doesn't have to dominate the overall commitment that I do love this person. I'm not excited about what they did in the last hour, but that's not the primary issue at hand.
Exactly. Exactly. And I always think about the triangular theory of love. I always talk about the commitment one first, the cognitive part, but that's not necessarily mm-hmm. true. Sometimes it is.
I honestly don't think it is. I don't think people mostly start out relationships with that. That real cognitive element, I honestly don't. I think when they meet, or even if you would talk about what happens to people when they do dating online. In fact, I was reading an article recently about that and, you know, kind of the pitfalls as well as the advantages. But it was that it was probably better to have, say, a first date be an activity where
yes.
you would get to know somebody, you know, there would be less pressure.
Yes.
Because the whole point was that if you had the classic, let's get together and have dinner, there would be a lot more pressure to move into the intimacy part really fast. You know, tell me all about your life, et cetera. When it's more likely that you want to find out, first, am I actually somewhat attracted to this person? And let's see if we sing together a bit rather than, you know, some big interview. And I don't think people mostly start out with some exceptions, actually,
mm-hmm.
with a, hi, I wrote my ad and my mission is to be in a relationship in the next year. Is that where you are at? Do you know what I'm saying?
I do, and I think that there aren't enough people that are that honest and upfront. And
right.
and then certain websites promote hookups, which is
right.
strictly passion,
right.
maybe a one-night stand. And Sternberg would say that if the triangle is mainly passion, which he has at the base of the triangle, then
right. And you have to also remember that what he really talks about, and in contrast to certain other approaches to love, Sternberg dares to say, I will tell you what love should look like,
mm-hmm.
Ideally. Other people say, hey, this is the way it is. But he uses the term consummate to,
mm-hmm. yes, he does.
To refer to if you can weave together in your love relationship elements of passion and intimacy and commitment and kind of have, you know, not utterly identical elements there, but they're all well represented. Then you have this thing he calls consummate. But he goes on to talk about how some people may really only have one of these elements
mm-hmm.
and that more commonly people have a blend of any two of the elements.
That's
so,
right.
One of the intriguing things is that he talks about what happens if you have passion and you also have intimacy. Commitment's not quite there. He actually calls that romantic love.
Yes, that's right. Romantic love, the intimacy and the passion, but not the commitment yet.
Right. And then we can scratch our head and say, well, how could that happen?
Uh-huh.
So we can come up with various scenarios why that happens, but one of the classics might be, so you had a summer romance. So was it really love? After all, it lasted a summer, and then we went our separate ways because we lived on two different coasts or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the Sternberg answer would be, well, what you experienced was romantic love, and mm-hmm. it was a form of love. It happened to have these two elements and not all three.
Mm-hmm. And then he has a companionate love, and
right.
that is commitment and intimacy, but no passion. Now, I happen to see, and I bet this is true for you too, lots of couples
yes.
who have that. They've
yes.
lost the passion, so they come for sex therapy. And
that's correct. Yeah.
But they do have the commitment, the cognitive part of love. They do have the intimacy where they feel like they can be vulnerable and talk honestly about what they want and need. So they have that intimacy, but they've lost the passion, which is the motivating part of love, so that
right.
you can have
and
that consummate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I was going to say, one hopes that that's how they come into therapy, because sometimes, mm-hmm. which is tougher to fix, as it were,
mm-hmm.
There are some people who will say, I'm with my partner. I knew my partner would be a good parent. I knew my parents would approve.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was the right time. We really liked the same things. It was really easy to talk to my partner.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I just took a chance that the sexual part would develop.
I know.
And,
I hear that a lot.
And then you say, have you ever had good sex with your partner? And I'm sure you've had the same experience there. Fortunately, it's a minority, but I can count, definitely, clients who say, never had good sex. And that
yeah,
is
and I always ask that question, too, because I want to see if there's any kind of a foundation on which to build.
Right.
And sometimes there isn't, because they don't know what good sex is. And they're,
I know.
And they just don't have the attraction. And I have found that if they don't, if one of them doesn't like the way the other one smells,
right,
that's like a deal breaker. Because that's so,
right.
that smelling part of our brain is so
it's
primitive.
Very primitive, right, and very mm-hmm. early established. That's right.
Yeah. So
I'm curious to ask you, so yeah. have you ever found any sort of remediation for that with somebody?
Sometimes you can get some of those flavored lubes and lotions at a lover store or a Babeland store, but
right.
usually it doesn't.
Right.
Now, it doesn't seem to make much difference. And I had one couple where he simply could not perform cunnilingus on her, which normally would be not a problem if the woman is clean and doesn't have an infection.
Right.
And
right.
most men say they
right.
like going down on a woman and they like her smell and they like her smell. And it evolves a little bit even as she gets more excited.
Right.
But there are exceptions. And they're rare, fortunately, because,
right.
you know, as sex therapists, Linda, we like to have results, and
right.
it's deeply satisfying work, isn't it, to be able
right.
to help people with such a core aspect of who we are,
right.
our sexuality.
Right. And happily, sometimes the issue is just, gee, you need to bathe more. And it's, ironically, I'm sure I've had men who have said, I can't go down on her. Maybe in my experience, it's just been men who say that about women, period. I'm sure I've had one or two where it was a specific woman, but I've had people that are just plain old complaining about body odor or scent.
Yeah, yeah.
The same thing. Sometimes that is remediated by just simply bathing, and other times it's like, it's something deeper than that.
Yes, you're right. All of that is true. And, you know, in terms of a man performing oral sex on a woman, cunnilingus. The woman, right, on some level, let's put the smell factor aside for a minute, the woman, right, on some level has to feel entitled to pleasure because it's a fairly passive activity. And a lot of women were raised, maybe it's changing now, I think with younger people it is, but raised to be the pleaser in the relationship. So, you know, it's a fairly passive thing if she's just lying back and her partner is between her legs pleasuring her. And, yeah. So then I, you know, a woman will sometimes express her worries and I'll say, well, how about taking a shower together first as part of the foreplay?
Right.
Or at the very least, washing yourself off with a little soap and water and a washcloth.
And, you know, the classic French thing about a perfume goes a long way. But
yeah,
that's true. I just want to add, when you mentioned young people, they're still, I'm around a lot of young people, not so much as clients, but as students.
Yeah, pause for a minute, Linda, and tell about your being a professor. Let the listening audience know about that.
Well, I've been teaching for decades, and I love doing it. I love the mixture of teaching and seeing clients. Mm-hmm. But I actually currently teach on three different campuses, and I teach a graduate level course in human sexuality for Pepperdine University. Mm-hmm. But I also teach a face-to-face full semester course undergraduate at Santa Monica College.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I teach an online class for a lesser-known community college at which I taught full-time for many years. And the two demographics of those two community colleges are somewhat different.
Mm-hmm.
But I can assure you that among young people, in general, I think what you've said is accurate, that there's more, I do deserve a good sex life, but it still remains interesting to me because I do give as an assignment. They don't have to read my book. I'm not that audacious, but it is given as an option, and a lot of students read it. And I wind up reading all those book reports. So one of the questions they have to answer is, what are the exercises you like the best and what are the ones you like the least? And I'm going to assure you that a lot of young women will say the exercise they like least is the one that suggests they self-stimulate. Now, that's not the same as oral sex, but those will be the same people who will also say something about, like in the creative love play and oral, I don't go there. It's just, and some of it, I don't want to say it's all based on ethnic background, but there is a trend that people from certain ethnic or religious backgrounds are the ones who are more likely to still be skittish about oral sex.
I'm going to guess that Catholics may be in that group.
Yes, but it's especially, and you sort of have to know the demographics of the L.A. area.
Okay, we so maybe Muslims too?
Yes, we have a lot of Persian Muslims.
Right, and so oral sex is not...
And oral sex is kind of no-no. Hispanic, and they may be Christian or Catholic. They'll identify as quote-unquote Christian.
Right.
And also, it's an official no-no in the Orthodox Jewish tradition, and Los Angeles indeed, the minority of American Jews are Orthodox, but that doesn't mean, I don't know if it's 10% of the whole population or what it is, but I assure you that there are practicing Orthodox Jews in the Los Angeles area.
Oh, many of them, and one of the things they have to do is to be able to walk to synagogue on Saturday. I know when I lived in Century City 10 years ago, there were a lot of Orthodox Jews in the neighborhood in Century City and across
the...
Yeah. And, Yeah, so religion comes in and some of the taboos. However, I will say about in the Jewish tradition, the Talmud, it says it instructs the husbands to give pleasure to their wives. And then the other thing that I really like about the Talmud is that when you have a spouse who dies, that you actually give your deceased spouse a compliment by remarrying relatively soon because it shows that you really liked being married and you had a good marriage.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, and I had to use some of that. You met my late husband, Charlie, because his first wife died of cancer, and some people, you know, people can be critical, and they thought, oh, we married too soon, even though it was a good, let's see, 94, 95.
Oh, it was a couple of years,
wasn't it? 3 years plus after his first wife died. But some people, you know, they just like to be critical. And so I loved quoting the Talmud on that. Well, in some religious traditions, this is considered a compliment, you know. So
right, and the Song of Songs is in the Old Testament, not New. That's true.
That's right. That's right. So let's see. Going back, we were talking about cunnilingus and teaching, and you've been teaching for decades, and I asked you.
Nice.
There are lots of things. I think the listening audience and many, many people listen to the archived version of this. Yeah. So you were saying that your students, we haven't talked about this, sentence stems, but we could do that, and then let's talk about how your students, what they really, really like, and we had planned on discussing that, would be your chapter on successful love skills. For tips for the anxious moments, because that's what lots of people that we see have anxious moments in sex.
Absolutely. I think, though, we want to start first. As I said, there's several different sections that classically get the most, you know, raves, or when I say raves, you know, what was the most valuable part of the book? And so the answers kind of are all over the board. The book, we should maybe point out to people, is divided into four main sections.
Mm-hmm.
And I do start with issues about talking about sex, both in and out of bed.
Right.
And then I'll give the overview, and then we'll go back. I then move into body issues, body love issues, and feeling comfortable with your body, which is an issue for so many people.
So many.
And then it addresses touch. All three elements, which very few do, affectionate touch, sensual touch, and then more sexually focused touch.
Mm-hmm.
And finally ends up with what I call daring love play, which my version of daring love play is fairly tame, actually. And, of course, the grand finale is what if you run into obstacles in doing all of this, which is the tips for anxious moments.
Yes.
But I think it's fair to say that it is the talk part and the creative love play part that I have, and the tips for anxious moments that kind of get most people's attention the most.
Yes. And I think the sentence stems that you write about, well, there you have them in various parts of your book, but I'm looking at page 45 now. And they're just very, it stimulates discussion, and it gets the couple talking about things they might otherwise not talk about. Something I really like about our sexual connection is, what really turns me on is, what moves me to orgasm is, and so on and so forth. This can help to have it written out, and then it gets the couple talking. So so many couples have so much difficulty talking.
Right. Well, yes, it's meant to be an icebreaker. And let's mm-hmm. clarify for people who might say, what do you mean a sentence stem? We're talking about an open-ended sentence that you're going to finish with the end of it. And the ones I have in the book are, I confess, I mean, they are skewed in the sense of they're skewed in the positive direction. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't something I don't like about our sexual connection. It was something I really like about our sexual connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I even do point out that sometimes people might want to tweak these little sentence beginnings and make them more pertinent. I certainly know for people who are not in therapy, the tweak positive is really the great direction to go. If somebody says, yeah, but we got all these problems, so this isn't working for me, well, then maybe you'd say, something I'd like to try in our sex life that we've never done before.
Yes.
Or something I think could help our sex life is, mm-hmm. you still got it focused in the positive.
Mm-hmm.
And it offers structure for people who, what do you mean I'm supposed to sit down with my partner and talk about sex? Like what? What should I talk about? And so that's what these sentence stems are designed to do, to help you open up.
And, so I like the way, for instance, one of yours is something I think would improve our sex life is, or
right.
one thing that worries me sexually or during sex is.
Right.
So those are still, you know, it's still keeping it in the positive focus, but it's allowing some concerns to be voiced.
Right, and it's funny that I said you could make it. I confess I'd sort of forgotten that I had those exact sentences. It was uncanny. They must be etched in my brain.
Yeah.
Already listed, but I still repeat, you can make up stems mm-hmm. that work for you if the ones that you see listed are not quite pertinent to your situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that gets the couple talking more and helps them be creative.
Exactly. In fact, I'm looking earlier on that list on page 46 now.
Yeah.
Something sexual I've always wanted to try is.
That's a wonderful one, yes.
Yeah, that is definitely
uh-huh.
Do I dare tell you? But that's the other. Obviously, this helps people feel close to each other.
Right.
Because they probably are disclosing things that maybe they haven't ever said before.
And so they feel very vulnerable. And, of course, back to Sternberg and his triangle of love. To
right.
feel the intimacy, you have to feel it's the emotional part of love, so you have to feel very comfortable being vulnerable and
right.
and expressing these very private things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We both know that we're in shock when we get clients, for example, who, you know, I didn't realize that's how you preferred to have me stimulate you. Or I thought you did reach orgasms, and people are sort
yeah.
of not
right.
saying some really basic things.
I know. I just talked to somebody earlier today who made an appointment, and I hear this all the time. He said, my wife and I are really good in every area except our sex life. And
right.
and we have trouble talking about it. And I hear this a lot.
Right.
So, and then I have clients who really do their homework, and that includes, I don't give it as homework, but they often go through and listen to a number of my past shows. And so
once it's
live and then it goes to archive, then it's a podcast. And, you know, they'll listen to shows and then they'll bring some of what they heard to the next session. And we'll talk about that. So, yeah, good for the media, right?
Yes, exactly.
It's such an amazing way to get out good, solid information. And I really love having you as a guest, Linda, because you're so bright and you're so experienced. Shall we move on to some specific tips for anxious moments?
All righty.
And that is on page 215 in your sixth edition book.
Exactly.
And you explain about baby steps, and I sometimes forget to explain this to clients because it's so integrated into my philosophy of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right.
But baby steps, successive approximation. And you write, the idea is to approach the desired goal very gradually, taking only one small baby step at a time, thereby experiencing as little anxiety as possible along the way. I think that is a very good explanation.
Oh, thank you. And I will say, I don't know if I want to edit my own sentence or not, but I do know that when we say experiencing as little anxiety as possible, that actually happens for a lot of people. There will be the minority of people that who, even if you suggest the baby step, and obviously a baby step for one person may not, you know, may be a bigger step for somebody else.
Exactly right.
But we also want to say, we're talking about minimizing it. It may or may not be at zero. You know, in other words, there'll be some people, I can't do that. I can't try that. That would, well, how uncomfortable? Well, I'm sure I'd feel a little uncomfortable. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
The idea is you're not throwing somebody into a pool. And I mean, what I'm about to say is sort of the macabre joke. But, you know, let's suppose a woman experiences pain during intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say, hey, I'll tell you the solution. Why don't you go home and have it 10 times in 2 days? That's absurd. That is, you know,
yes,
what?
Of course. and I guess women with vaginismus or vulvodynia, and their doctors, a lot of these MDs don't have a clue, and they'll say, oh, just go have a glass of wine and relax, and then they dismiss them and minimize it, and it simply does not help.
Exactly. And that you have to say, you know, I wasn't really planning to give such an extreme example of baby step, but I have worked with several women who had vaginismus, which was this automatic clamping down of the the vaginal muscles so that penetration was not even possible. And these are women who wanted to have penetration, but couldn't. And a lot of talk was involved in therapy and a lot of what might have triggered this, but taking it as what I often perceive it as a phobic response, the baby step that was effective for two different clients that I worked with was not the use of progressive dilators because those were too big. And the solution was, granted, again, I want to hasten to say there was a lot of talk about what all of this meant as well, was Q-tips.
Mm-hmm.
In my wildest dreams, I would not have thought initially of suggesting a Q-tip. It happened in my former days. I wore contacts. I was told to clean them with a Q-tip. And as I was thinking about a client and a little distressed about how we weren't doing too well, and cleaning with the Q-tip, I thought, I think I'm going to suggest a Q-tip in the next session.
Mm-hmm.
And shocking as it may seem, that was the baby step that broke the ice.
Yeah, I mainly work with Dr. Serena McKenzie, a naturopath specializing in sexual medicine, and she'll use a Q-tip in diagnosing these women who I just sent her a client of mine who became her patient, and this woman has had vaginismus for 10 years, and it was not diagnosed. And So it's just a shame. But now she's had physical therapy, and this Seattle area is wonderful. I think the L.A. area is, too, where you have pelvic floor physical therapy, where PTs work specifically. And with breathing, and that you go into in your book, to breathing exercises and relaxation, which is essential for them to overcome this. You know, it's a physiological response usually to emotional trauma in the past, usually.
Right. And let me give another example that isn't quite so extreme, you know. Let's say whether it's a man or a woman who says, I don't have any religious reasons or whatever, but I am kind of uncomfortable with oral sex. Then you have them make a list. Well, what could make it just a little bit more comfortable? Mm-hmm. And all sorts of things come into mind, whether it has to do with the exact position, whether it obviously would have to do with when bathing took place. And another one that some people don't think of so readily is, how much time are you going to spend? So that maybe the way you work your way into, I would like to enjoy giving or receiving, either way we go here. How about if I'll try 3 minutes, or maybe you make it 2 minutes. And the goal is not, I'm not headed off to, I'm going to have an orgasm, or I'm going to help my partner achieve an orgasm, but I'm just going to experience, I'm going to wade into the water. I'm not going to jump in the pool. I'm going to wade into the water and give it a little try.
And those are baby steps. And they will be facilitated, and you write beautifully about this in your book, Love Skills. Listeners, I encourage you to get this book. You'll be so glad you did. You can find it on...
The most recent edition is only on my website.
Okay, so, yeah, that's what I thought. So you're going to go to Dr. Dr. Linda D.E. Villers. .com. I'll put this in the write-up, of course. And so you'll want to get this book. It's such a good investment. So I really like the way you start out writing about relaxation exercises, and the first sentence is so true, and that is this: it's not possible, speaking physiologically, to be relaxed and anxious at the same time. It's just not possible. You cannot be relaxed and still be anxious at the same time.
Right.
So there needs to be systematic desensitization. And you go in detail so people can follow this, but they've got to practice it. Practice, repetition. It won't just work usually the first time. Deep muscle relaxation. Talk a little bit about that, Linda.
Well, I think this is the one that so many people have probably heard of over the years, that it's sometimes called progressive relaxation. It's the kind that a yoga instructor or a Pilates instructor, you know, somebody in a studio might use, which says, I want you to tense your toes and now relax them, and they work you through your entire body. That's kind of the classic approach to deep relaxation. But it's also possible to say, I'm just going to focus by breathing on, I'm going to let my mind visualize relaxation. I'm going to let it take me to a wonderful, tranquil beach or into the mountains in the quiet. I have sometimes made audio tapes for clients, and I always tell them to go to the place where they have had experiences of feeling very at peace and at one with the world. And so visual imagery of wherever that might be can help with this relaxation. I think a point to be making about relaxation exercises is that there's a wide variety of approaches to it, and you want to pick the one that you're the most comfortable with, you know, whether it is the tense release or whether it is deep breathing or imagery or the buzzword of the day, which I happen to not think is anything new. It's just the new buzzword, is mindfulness.
Oh, yeah, no, that's
mindfulness
big.
Meditation. So, you know, oh, well, I know something better than that. Well, we're just relabeling something that's kind of classic, but that doesn't make it not valid. It's quite useful. So whatever you want to call it or experience, there's such a thing as self-hypnosis, which is also a way of getting yourself to relax.
Yeah. And then you also point out that there are four major muscle groups in the body, and I suppose with progressive relaxation. So you've got the hands and the arms, and face, neck, and shoulder area, chest, stomach, and lower back, and four, buttocks, upper, and lower legs, buttocks, upper, and lower legs and feet.
Correct.
And so those are all the major areas that need attention. And by the way, lots of people store a lot, people who sit and do in front of their computers and all that, they store a lot of tension in their buttocks.
Correct.
So that needs to be dealt with.
And those who work at computers, they may, depending on the exact position of their hands to the board and so forth, can also often be experiencing a lot of neck and shoulder
Absolutely.
Tension.
Mm-hmm.
Not very good. That's right.
Not so good, no. And as an adjunct to all of this, I think getting a good massage, an outside good massage from a professional
masseuse. Absolutely. In fact, we could even mention, again, back to what one's personal preference is. I actually, this was a friend, not even a client.
Yeah.
But she said to me, this is a quote, "We wouldn't have a sex life if we didn't have a hot tub." She was a very intellectual, cerebral. She was a professor of philosophy.
Yeah.
But the way, you know, the cognitive brain got turned off finally was that they went in, the hot tub was literally a form of foreplay for them.
Oh, and of course it is for a number of people.
Sure.
Years ago, probably 30 years ago, I remember writing a prescription for a hot tub for a couple because they were so tense. And it actually helped them get it covered by insurance. It's probably totally illegal these days, but this was a while ago.
Well, but I understand the logic. That really was a creative intervention. Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, in the United States, massage is a billion-dollar industry. And as I understand it, blood tests for people that get regular massages. And lucky me, after this show tonight, I see a client, and then I see a woman where we do a trade, and we have for a number of years. She's a really good massage therapist, and so I give her an hour of therapy, and then she gives me an hour of massage, so I have that to look forward to.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, it shows that, so blood tests reveal that, those who've had a Swedish massage with moderate pressure experience decreases in stress hormones and increases in white blood cells. And so then that can mean that you're having a boost in your immune system. And then the light touch treatment showed higher levels of oxytocin because we know how good oxytocin is. And
we know the value of light touch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you've written a lot about touch, and I recommend to a number of my clients that the caressing exercises that you suggest.
Right.
They're really, really good. Anyway, I just wanted to say finally about massage, research shows a link between the many forms of touch, from massage to hand-holding even, to improved health.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's so true.
Yes.
I think we want to mention also, you know, we're talking about the forms of relaxation, and I said think positive, as it were, but one of the obstacles has to do with exactly this issue of what are you thinking or running through your head at the same time that you are attempting to tense and relax. And you know, as you know, I have gone on to discuss self-validation and self-soothing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm referring to the kind of comments that you need to be mentally making that are designed to replace what we call distress-maintaining self-talk, which is,
you know, a huge
barrier. Exactly.
Because you also have the self-soothing journal. I love this idea.
Exactly. And it, you know, some people will use a word like affirmations, if that makes one feel better to use that term. But the idea is I'm feeling relaxed and confident, not my sex life will never get better. This is what we mean by a distress maintaining self-talk or sabotaging self-talk.
Mm-hmm.
And it does take practice. It's easier said than done.
Yep.
to replace these thoughts that some psychologists call automatic thoughts,
mm-hmm.
others call them irrational beliefs. I believe it was Albert Ellis who used the term crooked thoughts, whatever you want to call them. They are not helpful. And
you even got a blurb from Albert Ellis, I guess, for your first book, because hasn't he passed on now?
Oh, I never dumped it off.
No, why would you? I remember hearing him years ago. And you put it in your book. He's the originator of rational emotive behavior therapy.
That's correct.
And you have it in essence, what rational support exists for your self-talk, what evidence exists to suggest your self-talk is exaggerated. What's the worst thing that could happen if things don't turn out the way you'd like? What positive things might occur if things don't turn out the way you'd like? Those are really important questions to ask.
Right. And it, you know, what it relates to, and I have a relatively new client right now, and I've had to be, you know, rather interventionist. He never. And I say, and this is a couple that have been in therapy with somebody else and said they worked on communication. I said, I'm thinking maybe you were exposed before to the risks of using absolutes. I think that was mentioned. And I literally stop her every time she says it. But she is, and see, I have to say, not she's always, she is frequently using the word always. And this is not helpful.
This is a no-no. Always and never.
It's an exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never get better. How about if we say it's going to take some work to get better?
Exactly.
And we're going to take those little baby steps and slowly but surely, I'm going to keep, then, you know, it's even the stuff we say, keep the faith, you know. I don't know about you, but there are certain
things. Well, I just think it's so helpful. You're positive, I'm positive. And I've been working with a couple since last June, and they were potentially facing, because they want so much to have a child, and that's a big motivator for some couples, right?
She
has vaginismus, and he was unable to ejaculate. And so, anyway, I gave them, whole lot of positive encouragement. And also that they could save about $30,000 in very expensive fertility treatments. And lo and behold, last night he ejaculated for the first time while awake. And this is an unusual case.
Oh, but, wow.
You know, it's significant.
Yeah.
It's really
and, you know, that makes me think of some of the, you know, the most amazing cases I've had. And mm-hmm. again, the power of the positive versus the negative. It was a couple, I'm trying to think of the details about, they had had intercourse, I think, years before, but now his erection problems were extreme. They hadn't had intercourse in a long, long time. And we were back to the good old hot tub, but it was hot tub plus a board game. Yeah. I actually used to sell it at workshops, but it still exists. It's called An Enchanting Evening.
I recommend it all the time.
All the time.
I have for years because I know Barbara and Michael Jonas.
Oh, really?
It really helps a lot of couples because they slow down.
That's correct. It has all the principles of sex therapy 101 built into it, even though that was not, I'm sure, their motivation for creating it. Yeah, but there's not a winner or a loser. It's playful.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I always encourage people to have sensual finger foods around while they played the game. But in any event, this couple had their hot tub experience, got out of it, played the game, and had successful intercourse for the first time in like 8 years or whatever it was. And poof. And then that did not turn into a one-time event because it was so, wow.
Yes.
We are capable. And then
it's
on the positive instead of on all the negative.
Exactly right. So I'm about to hear the music because we need to stop a few minutes before the top of the hour. So I want to let the listeners know that Dr. Linda DeVillers will return January 31st. We're going to talk about gay and lesbian relationships, and because that's part of her sixth fully revised edition for Love Skills, a fun, upbeat guide to successful relationships. And then besides that, we're going to talk about her wonderful book, Simple Sexy Food, 101 Tasty Aphrodisiac Recipes and Sensual Tips to Stir Your Libido and Feed Your Love. And I've tried a number of these recipes and they are delicious and they are aphrodisiacs. Of course, your attitude helps a lot, but they really are. Linda, you are a wonderful guest, and I'm so grateful that you came on today. And I'm not hearing the music, so maybe I got us off a little bit sooner than I needed to, but there's the music.
Yeah, there's your music. I was going to say, my clock says it's about time.
Yeah. Linda, we'll talk off the air before the next show. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Bye, everybody.